You're listening to episode 1 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, your host. This show is about GNU, Linux, and geeky topics. In this episode, we're going to be checking into Fedora, we're going to be checking out a new distribution called Mageia, and probably some other stuff too, so let's get started. Yeah, so what is going on with Fedora anyway lately? A lot of people have kind of said to me, gee, Klaatu, you don't really use Fedora anymore, blah blah blah. Well, I will not hesitate to say that Slackware for my production machines, the ones that I live on and work on and do multimedia on and everything else, I will say that that is the platform that I truly love and I dedicate a lot of time to. I maintain packages for, I write books about, I do like it a lot. However, there's something about Fedora that I keep coming back to, and there's a kind of rabid interest in it, because they are truly a very cutting-edge distribution, and I realize that that's kind of a cliche thing to say about Fedora, but it's actually true. I mean, it just is. They do a lot of the first things. They push the envelope, maybe a little bit too much sometimes. I guess it depends on how you look at it. But the sense of adventure is still there. And you can get the same sense of adventure with Slackware, believe me. I mean, if you follow Current, it's as an exciting ride sometimes as is Fedora. But it's a little bit different, because even when Slackware is current, they're pretty conservative, which I like. That's one of the reasons I like them so much. I also like that lack of a package manager. But with Fedora, I do enjoy it. It's an environment that I really do get a lot of satisfaction from using. I don't know. I mean, I can rationally tell you why, like I just did. I can tell you why I like Yum, things like that. But I think partly it is an irrational thing. It's just something that I like. I latched onto it early on, and you get comfortable with a distribution, and so you kind of settle in on it, and you like to follow it around. So on a spare laptop, I usually keep Fedora installed. Now, not all the time. Sometimes I'll take that spare laptop and put, for instance, last time I put PCBSD on it. Well, before that, it was FreeBSD. So, I mean, it goes back and forth, this laptop. But one of the projects that I like to keep up on, and kind of it's the default install for this laptop, is Fedora. And I'm almost ashamed to admit that I still distro hop secretly on a second laptop. But what can you do? You just like to follow these projects a little bit. Turns out Fedora 15 has been out for a while. Fedora 16 is currently in alpha or beta, depending on when this thing comes out or how quickly they move. I just wanted to kind of let you know that it's still a great little distribution. And, of course, I use the KDE version. KDE has come a long way, and to keep up with it, that's another great reason to run Fedora, because, again, they are cutting edge. They typically have the latest, greatest versions of KDE pretty quickly, so it's kind of nice. One of the things about KDE that in the past I have really, really not enjoyed was the KDE Network Manager. And raise your hand if you know what I'm talking about. All right, I see you all. So yeah, the KDE Network Manager was not in great condition for a very long time. I mean, I would go so far as to say it was unusable, because, I mean, certainly in Fedora 14, I don't remember which version of KDE that was, but in Fedora 14, it was replaced. I had to get rid of it. I had to install Wicked over it. And, yeah, so it was in bad shape, I feel. In Fedora 15, and whatever version of KDE I'm running on it right now, which really could be almost anything, depending on how often I've updated, so it looks like it's 4.6.5 KDE. The network manager is great. Now, I didn't test it. I didn't go and try every possible VPN configuration, anything like that. I have no idea. I'm talking about everyday use. The annoyance factor is not there. It's great. I take it to cafes. I take it to work or school, and it does the whole, you know, internet thing, the wireless network, the Ethernet network. Does it all just fine. It works splendidly. It's robust. It remembers connections. It connects when I want it to connect. It disconnects when I ask it to. It's really, really nice. So that was one of the main problems for me about, you know, the newer KDE implementations. And it is such a problem that, for instance, Slackware didn't, 13.37 didn't even ship with the KDE Network Manager. They didn't even bother. If I'm recalling correctly, maybe I saw it and intentionally didn't install it. Pretty sure it just didn't ship with it at all. And they're still using, and I'm still using on my Slackware Boxen, Wicked. I think, honestly, at least as of 4.6.5, this thing's usable. It's a nice little network manager. I've got no issues with it. Again, a little caveat emptor, I haven't tried anything fancier than everyday use. So if you're looking for something really, really fancy, I would look into this a little bit more than just hearing me say, oh, it's great, and just believing me. I mean, I know that it does handle VPN, it does handle mobile broadband, wireless, wired, things like that, but I've not actually tried anything but just normal wireless and plugging in an Ethernet cable, those kinds of things. But it's very, very nice. Another nice thing that I just kind of stumbled across was this page on the fedoraproject.org. It's called, well, it's admin.fedoraproject.org/pkgdb, so package database, /apps/name/list. I don't think that this is intended to be what I'm using it as, and I use it sort of as a shopping cart or a store, an app store. You go to this page and you can look at all the applications. I can't state enough, and I don't, it's again sort of irrational, but I really, really like these little websites where they show off all the different apps. I just think that that's a very natural thing for people to do. And frankly, it's a natural way for me to browse stuff too. I mean, when you're doing a search through your repository, you can do as many keywords as you want. You can say, oh, well, show me all the stuff in, you know, do a yum search for anything and then grep for music. Surely that will show me all the music applications. Well, not necessarily, because if someone didn't tag their application to say that it was a wonderful music-making tool and instead said that it was a cool, I don't know, tracker, then there's what keyword are you going to latch onto there? I like a website that has little icons by the name of the applications, and you can go and you can find the pretty icons and you can click on them first, because you know that you can always judge the effectiveness of an application by the prettiness of its icon. So you click on there and you read up on it and you look at it and maybe you click a button to install, all that other stuff. So it's really quite nice, actually, this little page of applications. And it reminded me when I saw it, and I got really excited because it reminded me of the PBI site that PCBSD has. PBI, as it turns out, Lord Drakenblut actually IM'd me the other day and told me that PBI stands for Push Button Installer. Didn't know that. But I like this concept, I really do, of having a website or a little, you know, for lack of a better term, app store, where you can browse through the applications. And you're probably thinking, but Klaatu, there's PackageKit. What's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with that is that it's still not the same thing. You know, you don't get that same feeling of, oh, look at all these apps that I've got to choose from, and here's these categories that I can look through. Or maybe not. Maybe I just browse through a big list, but if something has a cool name, or if something has a cool icon, or something, some one of the one-line descriptions catches my eye, then I can investigate further. And I've already found, like, three new applications just by going through there and rediscovered one, the Agave one. So it's cool. I like it. I don't think that this is exactly what they wanted it to be. I don't think that's the intention here, but it really is a good start. And I think things like that are great both for just in your idle time when you're looking for cool new apps, as well as for that proverbial new user that we're always thinking about who wants to go online and look for applications to download and install, because that's what they've been trained to do. Granted, we might want to be retraining them not to do that, but if there are safe places for them to do that, maybe it's not such a bad idea, especially since it is a lot easier to browse through applications when you're completely unfamiliar with the application set. It's really nice to have something to kind of just window shop. I don't mean Windows shop, I mean to window shop. Okay, so speaking of those proverbial new users, I was thinking the other day, and I've been thinking about this a lot, of course, because one does think about these things, and it's kind of like, well, if someone came up to me suddenly, unexpectedly, and asked me, I want to switch, or said to me that they wanted to switch to GNU Linux, what distribution should they use? I found myself being completely, I would not be ready with an answer. I mean, if they were a close friend, or someone who I was going to work with on an everyday basis, I wouldn't hesitate. I'd say, oh, Slackware, of course. Let me set it up for you. Let me configure your KDE for you, because I know the best way, of course, to configure KDE. I know all the keyboard shortcuts to create for you. I know how everything should look. I know how to hide all the useless menu bars at the top, and so on and so forth. But if it was just someone random who I didn't really have confidence that I was going to be able to help and go to and say, okay, here, let me fix that for you, or let me show you how that's done, all that other stuff, I don't know the distribution that I would say, here, this is the one that I can give to you and tell you that that's really, really nice. To some degree, it used to be Fedora because it was very pretty, and it had that great boot startup screen with the logo. And I would like to continue to say, yes, that's the way I would go. But I think that if I was going to go that route, I would not go the KDE way. Even though I just finished raving about the KDE version of Fedora, I don't know that I would just send them off with a Fedora disk, a KDE Fedora disk, and say, okay, go for it. Because I've seen it in real life. I've already experienced it with a couple of people that I've said, here's a Fedora disk, knock yourself out. They went, and they did knock themselves out. They installed the thing, or I helped them install it, and then they're calling me up with problems. You know, the KDE network manager's not working right. How do I get rid of that? And so I struggle for 3 hours trying to get that to work and then swap it out with Wicked. Obviously, this was back in the Fedora 14 days. Why do I keep getting these notifications about entering my password for KWallet all the time? What is that password? Why do I get these pop-ups about updates needing to be done every day? And honestly, I believe that that might be true. I believe that the default setting for the update daemon on Fedora, I think it does seem to be daily, whereas for a new user, the default really, really ought to be more like every week, maybe, or something like that, but certainly not every day. So it was... It's not that it's not polished, not that it's not good, it's just that it might not be the impression I want to send someone off with. The GNOME version might be different, and unfortunately I haven't really played around with it as much to know for sure, and it does take a lot of playing around with, and it usually even takes really some sucker to come along and say, hey, what can I install on this computer? And then you give them that disk, and then you see how many problems they come back with you, to you with. So I haven't had experience with that. But I do feel just maybe that Fedora is a little bit too cutting edge to send off with a new user and just kind of like, okay, see you later, bye. That might be a little bit bold. So I was kind of on the hunt for something that I was familiar with, because, you know, you don't want to say, well, here's a Linux Mint disk, knock yourself out. Because I haven't used Linux Mint enough so that when they call and they ask, hey, how do I do such and such, that I would feel that I would know how to solve everything simply, you know, with a few commands or a few, well, go down to this menu, open this and do that. I feel like that's a big problem. You know, if you're not recommending the Linux that you use to people, then you're kind of setting yourself up for some really fun support calls, because you're not going to know, and you're going to have to reboot your machine into a live CD and then start reverse engineering what they're going through, and it's not cool. So I was looking for something stable, polished, and familiar. I remembered Mandriva. I thought, hey, Mandriva was a really slick distribution. It was really nice and stable. It was polished. I really liked it. I really enjoyed it on my Triple E PC. I had very fond memories of it. Of course, the big news about Mandriva is that it's, no one really knows what's going on with it, so there's this new thing called Magia, Mageia. It's kind of old news now, but they recently released version 1.0 of Magia, and so I decided to download it. It was a 700 megabyte download, not a big deal. Live CD, KDE based, which was important for me. Of course, it's RPM based, although they don't use Yum, they use URPMI, but the command set is really, really similar to just straight up RPM, and I decided to give it a shot. So I booted it up onto a spare computer, just on the live CD, and kind of poked around with it. And I just wanted to kind of give you some impressions of it, because Mandriva is nice, and it turns out Mageia is really, really nice. I kind of went to their site, poked around early on, and I liked what I saw. I thought it was, you know, it was looking promising, and I thought, well, certainly you know, Mandriva is certainly a good bet, a good thing to base yourself on, so that seems very promising. And it's really come a long way. If you went to their site after the news of them forking off of Mandriva developed, then you should go back now, because it's really, really, it's just, they got it together. Not that they didn't have it together before, they just really pulled it together now. It's a really slick-looking site. They've got a nice new logo and a nice little, you know, a text brand. Looks really, really slick. And once you boot up to it, it looks just as good. It's a beautiful, beautiful design. It looks really, really nice. Its implementation of KDE is very, very nice. It's very well put together. It doesn't seem rough around the edges in any way, either visually or just functionally. You know, you don't get like weird things going on in KDE. It seems like someone actually sat down and kind of pre-configured it with some kind of intention. You know, they make it quite nice. They're not using the big searchable kicker, or the, what was it, searchable, like the K menu thing. They're not using that. They're actually just using the old style menu, which I don't love, admittedly, but it does work. It is functional. I prefer Lancelot myself, but hey, whatever. They've got the desktop set up for the folder view, as they call it, so that means that the desktop, you can have icons on it. Again, not actually my preference, and I know some people do like that, so I guess that's great for them. Myself, I would switch it over to the normal KDE desktop view, where you can't have icons. But whatever. It's very nice. It's got some really helpful, or rather useful, icons on the desktop, and that is kind of nice for your first install. There's the Join the Community icon, and there's the Install icon, and then, of course, there's your Home, and I think a trash can. So it's very functional, you know? You boot it up, and there's, it's intuitive. It becomes like, yeah, yes, I know what to do. There's a Home folder. I will click on it. There's a trash can. I know what goes there. There's a Join the Community. Gee, that sounds really nice. There's people around I can be friends with. And then there's the Install, of course, so you install it. So that was really cool and impressive. But I think more than almost any of that stuff, well, actually two things. Stable. It's very stable. It feels, I mean, it is, right? It's exactly like Mandriva. It just felt very nicely, refreshingly solid. I didn't feel like I was ever on the border of having an application crash or having annoying pop-ups or little plasmoids crashing or anything like that. It felt quite stable, like they really had put together the conservatively stable things that you know, it's not old by any means, but it doesn't feel like it's something that you're testing. This is a production environment kind of desktop, and that is very significant. That's very important, because I really don't think that if you're pitching GNU Linux to someone, I really don't think that they're down for this idea of, oh, there's some really cool new features. Do you want to try them for us? And possibly you could get into bug reporting for us. No, they're still trying to figure out how they start Firefox. They don't want to be testing anything. So Mandriva felt very, very stable. And honestly, I would almost feel better about, not almost, I would, but I mean, amazingly, I would feel better about pitching Magia to a new user than I would, for instance, Ubuntu. While Ubuntu has that great thing about it that it kind of installs on anything with minimal effort and kind of grabs all the drivers whether you like it or not and installs them for you, I mean, that is very handy for the new user. I completely identify with that. But it's just, they make those weird kind of, we're going to be just cutting edge enough to be scary decisions, and that's always puzzled me about Ubuntu, and I guess that's the point of those long-term releases, but I feel like I shouldn't need a long-term release. I should have a distribution that releases their version, and it is your environment, and you can rely on it, and you don't have to think about what happens in 6 months. It's just something that you can run. I realize that you can do that with Ubuntu, so I'm not being fair, but I am saying that I feel better about something like Mandriva or Magia. And I would say something like Red Hat or CentOS or whatever, but they're not going for the desktop market. They've made that very clear. And like I say, Fedora feels a little bit too cutting edge to me, so I'm really kind of digging this Magia, stable, but also very kind of new user friendly. The look and feel of Magia, basically the same as Mandriva. So if you've ever used Mandriva in the past, probably 2 years, Magia is going to look and feel exactly the same, which is mostly a good thing. I mean, I never really loved their glossy look, but I mean, big deal, you can change it. But I think other people would like it anyway. But the really cool thing is that they borrow the control panel from Mandriva. And if you're familiar with the Mandriva control panel, then you probably really like it. I know that I do. Personally, I think that system settings in KDE is fine. It's perfect. It's everything I ever wanted a system settings to be. That said, I don't think it's as wonderfully intuitive as, for instance, the Mandriva or the Magia control panel. And by that I mean, there should be a place on a computer, I think, that one could argue. I mean, I say it, but I don't actually use it. But there should be, for users, I think, a place where they can go. And it will be a technical place. And they'll be a little bit scared of it, but they'll know that they can go there and they can set up things, advanced things that they don't really understand, but it will help them through that to some degree. Things like network shares, things like finding out what hardware you have, setting up different connection options that you want to have on or off, you know, SSH and things like that, printers, you know, all those different things, those really, really technical, scary things that new users don't like to mess with. But again, if they've got to do it, you might as well consolidate it into something that looks friendly, that helps them through it a little bit, not too much. It doesn't have to be for dummies, but it should be consolidated. It should be all right there. They shouldn't have to dig around too much for these things. I don't know. I think there's something about control panel that says it all. It's a control panel. That's where you control your computer. I'm really liking Magia. I'm really enjoying using it when I do use it. It's on a spare computer. It's not something that I use every day, all day. But I've for certain tasks, when I'm in this one of the rooms, that's the computer that I go to. I use it for pretty much everything that I do outside of my office right now. Not at the cafe. I mean, in the building, but outside of my office. So it's been really, really great using it. I've been really impressed with it. So if you're looking for a nice, stable environment that is based on the whole RPM thing, and I know that's not hip right now. You're supposed to hate RPMs and really, really love Debs and Pac-Man, right? Something like that, I don't know. But if you're looking for a stable environment to pitch to someone who wants to use GNU Linux and you're just a little bit nervous about sending them off with something too complex or too cutting edge or whatever, then Magia might be the way to go. Well, that music means that it is time for coffee, so let's go get a cup for ourselves and come back and talk a little bit more about geeky stuff. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the whole new user experience briefly. I know I talked about it a little bit there in the Magia review, but I wanted to touch on one more idea that I've been thinking about lately. And that is the old cliche that Linux can run on everything. And of course this is true, and it's very great, and it's very cool that Linux can run on anything. It's fantastic that it has so much support for so many different computers. It makes old computers new again. It really is very powerful. And I can attest to this because as I've said before, I think I've got lots of power PCs around here at this new job, and they're all up and running now, actually serving useful purposes, like they're being used on a daily basis because of Debian PowerPC build. So it's a big deal. But I've noticed that sometimes this becomes a selling point, it seems, when you're pitching GNU Linux to other people, and you tell them, oh, you know, you should just grab a spare laptop, one of your older computers, and throw Linux on there, because, you know, Linux will run on anything. Well, again, there's nothing misleading about that. It is very true. But you're kind of setting yourself up, I think, for maybe some disappointment. You're kind of setting up the person for a little bit of disappointment, too. If they're looking over your shoulder, and you're running GNU Linux on some modern laptop or modern computer, it's got all the whiz-bang features, even the subtle ones. I'm not even talking about the fiery windows and the exploding windows and things like that. I'm just talking about simple things like the cube switch when you switch desktops in KDE, or the subtle blur effect when you launch Lancelot or one of the plasmoid things, and it covers up something in the background, and the thing in the background becomes blurred, and there's a little bit of transparency going on, or even just the overall responsiveness of a good-looking desktop, like, for instance, KDE, or it could be GNOME 3, whatever. Point being that there's a certain kind of expectation that, okay, that is a modern computer, it's running a modern OS, and it looks a certain way, and it feels a certain way. That's what people are going to expect, because that's what they're doing on their current computer, most likely. They're using their little Windows thing, or their Mac, and everything is kind of at a certain point. And then if you tell them, well, take an older laptop that you have lying around, or an older computer you have lying around, and throw Linux on there, it's not an upgrade, and in fact, it might not even be a cross-grade. In a lot of cases, for Mac OS especially, and I don't know what it's like on the Windows side, but, you know, an older Mac will run an OS that is maybe a little bit older, but it runs it just fine. I mean, Mac OS, an older version of Mac OS, just fine. Whereas you throw Linux on there, and Linux can't recognize the graphics card because it's extremely, extremely proprietary, or it's just such a rare little graphics chip that Linux never really bothered keeping up the support because only 3 iBook users out there in the whole world really would bother with it anyway. So you're kind of downgrading the person, and then you're expecting them, possibly cross-grading them, and then you're expecting them to be really impressed by this cool free OS that, oh, by the way, might not really have graphics support, and if it does, it might be kind of clunky and slow, and it's just not going to be the same experience. They're going to look at that, and they're going to think, wow, this is a really clunky OS. It's kind of novel that it exists, and it's on an old computer, and it's kind of usable, although I'm not really familiar with any of the applications that it has. Okay, interesting. And then they'll walk away from it, and that's probably the best-case scenario. Well, not best-case. Best-case would be they are really into it, they break open a terminal and start using all the cool Unix commands that you really want them to use. But slightly down from that would be, okay, shrug of the shoulders, walk away. So I'm not saying that people should be inspired to go out and buy a new computer just to try GNU Linux. I mean, that's counterproductive in the sense that we're trying to make technology last longer than intended from the original manufacturer, who's, of course, doing this whole defective by design kind of thing, planned obsolescence. We are trying to thwart that, I think, as a community by the longer support and stuff like that, but at the same time, if you want people to get an idea of what Linux is capable of, and if you're taking them off of a modern computer with a modern graphics system with a modern OS, and then you're downgrading or barely cross-grading them over to something somewhat similar in functionality and probably clunky because it doesn't have the support, or you're driving it a little bit too hard because you've got last year's or this year's GNU Linux distro running with you know the latest greatest KDE or GNOME 3 running on a 3-year-old computer. Again, that doesn't seem so absurd, but in a lot of different ways it would be kind of crazy. Okay, maybe 3-year-old is maybe that is a little bit crazy. Let's say a 7-year-old computer. It's just not going to be the same performance. And so expecting someone to be impressed by that just isn't realistic. And I think that one thing that a lot of us geeks get into is just the sheer excitement that GNU Linux exists at all. I am excited about this myself, frankly. I mean, putting Debian 6 or 5 on a G4 and having it serve as a production sandbox for the web developer, that is very exciting. That is super cool. I mean, someone's been using a PowerPC box from I don't know how long ago with Debian Linux on it, and they have no idea. That's cool to me. But that's not cool enough to tell that to convince that web developer to install GNU Linux on her MacBook. It's not the same. There's no correlation there. Seeing command line interface on an old computer might be really exciting to us geeks, but to other people, even the vaguely geekier side of the normal people, that's not exciting. So I'm simply issuing some advice here, not that you asked for it, but the advice would be that if you're trying to turn someone onto GNU Linux, make sure that you're presenting it in a way that is equal or greater than what they are currently using. because otherwise it's going to be a tougher sell. And now for the meat and potatoes of this Ogcast episode, and by meat, of course, I mean vegetarian soy product, and by potatoes, of course, I mean GNU Privacy Guard. I don't know if I've talked about this all that much on this series, the free version of PGP, which is Pretty Good Privacy, which of course is the GNU Privacy Guard, otherwise known as GPG. Without going into what exactly that is or how it works, it's a really good way to be able to verify the identity of a person that you are, for instance, emailing back and forth. The idea is that they have a private key, you have their public key, they have your public key, and you've got your private key. And if you use the combination of your private and their public key to encrypt something for them, then they in turn can use the combination of your public key and their private key to then decrypt it. It's fairly simple, and it does tend to make communicating with one another pretty reliable. You know, if someone's emailing you and claiming to be someone else, and they've digitally signed their email with some kind of code that your email client can then look at, decrypt, and verify, yep, the person who claims that they are this person, they've sent me some code that I can understand if I use their public key and my private key, so it must be the same person. That's basically how it works. The same idea goes for things like SSL, and even, I think, SSH, if I'm understanding correctly. I could be wrong about the SSH one, but it's similar in concept. Certainly, like, if you're doing SSH keys back and forth between a server, it's similar to that. The server's got your public key, you've got your private key, you can verify one another's identity, essentially, when you're signing into your server to administer it. So it's a trust-based model, meaning that you develop trusted contacts over the course of time. It removes any kind of middleman from this scenario, because, for instance, if you're just relying on, I don't know, Gmail, for instance, to kind of let you know whether or not the person who's emailing you is indeed the person you think is emailing you, then you're just kind of hoping that Gmail hasn't been compromised in any way, and that probably if it comes from gort@gmail.com, then it's probably really Gort, no problem. Could be fake. How would you ever know? Well, you couldn't really ever know until perhaps it's too late. So the GPG thing will allow you to have a little bit extra confidence in the idea that this is really the person who you think it is, because if someone's emailing you consistently with their digital key, and it decrypts every time, and it verifies, and it's them, and then suddenly they start emailing you without the key, or they email you with some other key that your system doesn't recognize as belonging to that person, then you know that something might be amiss. How often is this really a problem? Well, I don't know. Happily, we don't live in such a state that this really is a huge problem yet. I haven't really been scammed by anyone over email yet because they've been claiming to be someone who they're actually not. The other side of that question would be, how do I ever know that that person's really that person? And to some degree you don't, but you do know that someone online claiming to be Gort is emailing you consistently from an email address, gort@whatever.com, and they've got this key that consistently decrypts to verify their identity as this Gort person. Now, until you meet them in the flesh, see some ID, wink, wink, and kind of get to know them, you might not even be able to really believe that they are who they say they are. But, I mean, at that point, you're just getting down to the sort of, what does it matter, you know, who they say they are? I mean, if their purpose is being served and they want you to call them Gort, then as long as it's the same Gort every time, then at least you can trust that. So we're not talking about DNA level of trust here, but you are talking about, here's some person that I'm talking to. They have the password to their own GPG key. They send me email with a digital signature attached to their email address, and my email client continually decrypts it to the same thing every time, so it must be the same person. It's really that basic, and it's really, really handy, and I think it's really, really handy for future-proofing ourselves, because I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't anticipate people stealing people's identities over email or anything, but if no one ever is using GPG, then when you start using GPG, it's going to be tougher to get started, and it also, I think, is going to send up some red flags. You know, if you're emailing back and forth and there's nothing at all suspicious about your emails, nothing really to hide, for instance, and then suddenly you start emailing back and forth with GPG keys and you're encrypting your messages and digitally signing them and everything like that, then suddenly it's just like, what are these people up to? Not that anyone's looking. Not that anyone's bothering looking at your emails or whether they're signed or encrypted or not. I'm just saying, if you set the precedence right now that no, whoever you are, whatever server you are, whatever provider you are, whatever email service I'm using, you are not permitted to review the contents of my email, then that sets that precedence. That says, I don't care what you think about whether or not privacy is important and whether or not I have a right to send back and forth email that people can't read during, you know, between the sender and the receiver, then that's an important precedence to set, I think. So I think that GPG is a really good system to use. I think it's something that especially hackers really, or geeks, whatever, should really start using more often, because it's just something that really enables you to add a level of security that might not be that important right now, but eventually it might be. I mean, look at SSL right now. It's I haven't seen anyone lately saying SSL is the greatest system ever. You know, I mean, in fact, I've heard of a lot of things saying that SSL is pretty shaky, and there are even alternatives coming up to open SSL. Look at convergence.io, for instance. It's actually going back to this kind of model where you can start okaying and giving levels of trust to certain sites that you say, well, they're signed with a certificate, so I feel pretty good about that server. I feel like that's probably the official sort of canonical server for that site, so I'm going to trust that digital signature. And my friends can look at who I trust, and they can choose to trust those same servers. And it becomes sort of this web of trust, rather than, for instance, simply saying, here, VeriSign, I'll give you a lot of money, and now you can, and now whatever I give my users with that SSL cert, it's going to be marked as implicitly trusted by every web browser, because all those web browsers are just pandering to you. It's a really, really weak system that relies on some big third party that, you know, no one really even knows. I mean, I don't know what VeriSign is or whoever manages those things, whereas some other people who might trust a certain server or might trust a certain set of servers, and if I trust them, okay, I feel pretty good about that. At least I have a little bit of accountability. I've got a little bit of assurance that I can reach out and say, hey, why did you trust this server? Haven't you noticed how often their certs have been changing lately? What's going on with that? Maybe they know the person who manages the server. Maybe they can tell me. You know, so it's a lot more direct. I really do favor the lessening of abstraction with actually a lot of things, but trust and identity for sure. I should mention, of course, that signing your message with your GPG key is not the same. That's a digital signature. That's not the same thing as encrypting your entire message with GPG. So I want to talk about signing right now, just to get the GPG stuff up and running. I'm going to talk about a couple of different mail clients, including Mutt, Kmail, and Thunderbird. Okay, so first of all, you need to get a GPG key, which is really actually quite simple. Simply open up a terminal and type in GPG space dash dash gen dash key. That's G-E-N dash key. That's going to generate a GPG key for you, but it places you directly into a menu of which kind of key you want to generate. I usually just go with the default because I know nothing about this encryption stuff, so I just go with RSA and RSA. You can certainly go for something different if you want, but I just go ahead and hit return for the default. It gives you an option of how long you want your key to be. I have kind of taken to choosing the greatest value possible, which in this case is 4,096 bits, and then it asks you how long it should be until your key expires. I go for zero. That is, I don't want the key to expire. If I need to revoke it, I'll revoke it. Otherwise, I'll keep it for life. So is this correct? Then I say yes. And then it starts asking you for information about yourself. So this is, for instance, identifying stuff that people are going to be able to latch on to think, okay, this person is who they say they are. I will trust their key if they ever meet you in real life. It's also the stuff that people are going to be able to identify you with when they're searching for your key. Because obviously if you want to send in digitally signed messages to people, then you're going to want them to have access to your public key so that they can use your public key and their private key to decrypt your message. And that way you can also grab their public key from a server, a key server, and that way you can use your private key and their public key to encrypt the message, or rather to digitally sign the message. So I'm going to put in CLAT2, and it asks me for my email address. This is an identifying email address. It would behoove you probably to do the email address that you actually use. So I'll do the CLAT2 at member.fsf.org, and then a comment. And I don't know what the comment is intended for. I usually put some kind of identifying information so that if there are two CLAT2s on key servers, which I'm sure there are at least two, then they could read the comment and see which CLAT2 I am if they don't recognize either my name or my email address. So I'll just write in here that I'm the CLAT2 who does the podcasting for Hacker Public Radio and GNU World Order. So that should help people figure out that the CLAT2 that they're looking at is the CLAT2 who is me. And then it will ask you for verification. You can edit anything that you need to edit, or you can simply hit O for OK and return. Now it's going to ask you for a passphrase. The passphrase is very important. It's not like an SSH key where maybe you don't have a passphrase because part of your purpose for using the SSH key is so that you don't have to type in passwords when you're logging into servers or something. It's not that way. This is a passphrase that you're going to use whenever you want to encrypt and decrypt messages or digitally sign or digitally sign messages. Why is that important? Well, because you don't want someone to sneak up behind you and start emailing people and signing your emails, you know, signing these emails with your digital signature unless they have your GPG key password. So it's a very real added layer of security for these GPG keys. So for that reason, I wouldn't use the same password that you use for login, that sort of thing. Because if they've already gotten your login password, then the first thing that they're probably going to guess for your GPG key would be your login password. So probably not something that you'd necessarily want to use for that. Once you've chosen your passphrase, then it will start generating the GPG key. Now, it's going to generate it pseudo-randomly as best as a computer can, I guess. Which, of course, is not very random, so it needs some degree of entropy. So it will ask you to type on your keyboard, move your mouse around, utilize your disk. So I generally try to open up a program and start using it, you know, even if it's just like K blocks or Tetris or whatever. Just kind of generate activity on the computer so that this thing can use the randomness of those events to help generate the pseudo-random key that it is going to produce for you. And it could take a little while, because certainly if you chose a 4096-byte key, then you need a lot of entropy to help it generate all those random bits. When it is finished, it will dump all the output, or not all the output, but it will dump a report into your terminal. The main thing about this report that you'll need is the public key ID, which you'll see on the line labeled pub, P-U-B. So in my case, it would be 5000280F, and that's the key ID that I can use to identify this GPG instance. If you're happy with a key, if you're going to keep it around and treasure it and actually start using it, you kind of need to get it out there into the world. One of the most convenient ways to do that, I mean, aside from just posting the public key itself, like on a website that you maintain, that people know you for, which is certainly an option, but the other way to do it would just be gpg --send key. And then we need to define a key server. We're going to send it up to a server. So --key server, all one word. And then the one that I can seem to remember off the top of my head every time is pgp.mit.edu. And then the identifying, you know, the key ID. So 5000280F. And then return, and that sends your key up to a key server. Now, if I know that you have a GPG key, you send me an email, hey, I didn't ever get your public key. then I can get it. I can do a GPG search dash key, and then again define the key server that I want to search. So it's a network, so I mean technically speaking, it, you know, it should propagate itself over all of these key servers. So even if I look on pgp.mit.edu and you had sent it to some other key server, given a little bit of time, it will show up on the MIT server as well. And then I would type in maybe your name, or if you told me the identifying key code, then I could just search for it by that specific number. But if I didn't know that, then I could search for Gort. Let's see if that comes up. Yeah, there's a couple of people with Gort in their key name. So there you go. Then you can import the one that looks right to you, and then you've got their public key, and you can start decrypting their digital signatures, you can decrypt their messages, you can start sending them messages, or send them digitally signed messages, whatever. So, I mean, that was the quick primer on GPG itself. Wasn't actually the point of the segment. The other point of the segment is that you then need to start actually utilizing it, you know, because it's similar to SSH, but it's not quite the same thing. It's not one of those things where you can just kind of have it on the command line and tap into it whenever you need to, use it to sign into something. It's not like that. You want to integrate it, because otherwise you're not really using it. And, I mean, I've had a GPG key for a very long time, and I used it for a while when I was on KMail, and then I switched over to Mutt and didn't know how to do it on Mutt, so I kind of fell out of the habit. Now I'm back into it, so turns out there's a couple of different programs that will easily enable you to start using this brand new shiny GPG key that you just made yourself. The programs that I've used it on are Mutt, Pine, KMail, and Thunderbird. If I recall correctly, Pine was a little bit obtuse. You had to come up with some aliases to get GPG working correctly, because you needed an alias for the GPG signing and the GPG decrypting and the GPG something else, encrypting, I would think. So that was a little bit obtuse. I believe I memorialized and recorded how exactly to do that in an old Hacker Public Radio episode. So if you're using Pine, if you want to start using Pine, and you want to start using GPG as well, go there. It works splendidly. You just have to know how to implement it. KMail makes it really, really simple. You simply go into the KMail configuration. It's a nice GUI menu. You set up your accounts in KMail just like you would with any other mail client. And while you're setting up an identity for KMail, then you can also add to that identity the key that you want it to use. And KDE and GPG play very well together. They're totally integrated. It's quite seamless, actually, so give that a shot. That's a really, really easy one. Thunderbird is a little bit less integrated, and it requires the plugin Enigmail, E-N-I-G-M-A-I-L. It's a pretty simple plugin to get started. I mean, it's a plugin for a Mozilla app. It's very easy. Simply look it up, grab Enigmail, and then configure Enigmail again with that key. And after that, it's pretty seamless as well. A little bit more difficult is the Mutt configuration. And it's so complex that I'm not even going to bother trying to explain exactly what you need to do. And I'm going to refer you instead to the demonstration, or the tutorial, I guess you could call it. It's not really a tutorial. On some guy's website, it's really just basically a code dump. It copies and pastes a bunch of the different options that you need to have in your MUTRC file. So the website is mati.fsinf.at/node/17. I will put that in the show notes for sure. And you can also just probably search for how to use GPG on MUT, and then the word MATI, that's the guy's name, I guess, or MATIS actually is his name. So, yeah, it's a good little post. It's from, like, 2007. I guess it's been around a while. I hadn't found it previously, so I don't know what magical term I used this time for it to actually come up quickly and easily in the search engine, but that's great. So if you copy all of that page of text that he dumps into his site and place that with a few modifications into your .mutrc file, then you can start using GPG really quite seamlessly within Mutt. The crux of it is you set the PGP reply encrypt, you set the PGP reply sign encrypt, and the command that it's going to issue when it wants to do different things like decode, verify, decrypt, and sign any message coming in or out of your Mutt mail program. You can also import keys from there, you can export keys, you can verify keys. I mean, there's actually quite a bit of basically all the GPG stuff that you would normally do on a command line, you can practically do from within Mutt, which is really, really nice. So it just gives it to you like in the little mini buffer down at the bottom, or whatever Mutt calls it. I think of it as a mini buffer because that's what Emacs calls it, but whatever Mutt calls it, that's where you can do all this GPG stuff. Only modification you really need to make to the text block that he gives you to paste into .mutrc is the ID of the key that you are using. You need to place that in two different places, and one is the easy one is the very last line. It says OpenGPG colon ID and then the number, and just 1, 2, 3, 4 lines up from that, set PGP underscore sign underscore as equals, you want to put the number there as well. Now, after the number on the bottom line, so it's my underscore HDR, I don't know what that stands for, open PGP colon space ID equals, and then the number of your public key, which, again, in my case, is 5280F. Then there's a backslash, semicolon, backslash in, backslash T. Again, no clue what any of that means. And then URL equals, and then HTTP colon slash slash. And in the example on the guy's website, he has his server name, fsinf.at/public_key.asc. So obviously he's stored an ASCII version of his key on his server, and he's referring to that here. If you don't have that available to you, although honestly that's the easier way to do it, but if you don't have it available to you, you could paste in your own ASCII key right there. Now the ASCII version of your public key is very, very long. It's easy to get, but it's kind of difficult to paste, to be honest, but you can do it, and it is GPG space dash dash export space dash A, and then whatever username you want to export the key of, so that's CLATU, and then the greater than to redirect that output to tilde, for instance, tilde slash public underscore key dot ASC, why not? And that will give you a dump of your key, your public key that you've just exported, and a big long list of just random characters. It's really ugly, really, really long. And if you're going to paste it into your MuttRC, then you have to go to the end of each line and put a backslash so that it's a continuous string of random characters so that it doesn't interpret them each as a new line, or else it'll throw all kinds of errors when you start Mutt. So it's a little bit difficult. I just went ahead and uploaded my key to my server, and I refer to it just like he does, URL equals, and then the URL of the location of that key. But you can do it whatever way you prefer. And now when you use Mutt, after you start it, and you can compose a message, I'll resume the message I started earlier, you can send emails to whoever you want to send it to. And once you're at the final screen, when you're about to send your email, you've composed it, you've saved it, you're about to send it, you can hit the default here that we've set is P, as in PGP, and it brings down, again, in the little mini buffer down at the bottom, a menu of all the different GPG or PGP options. You can hit, well, by default, it's set to sign the message. But here, with the options, the menu, you can hit E for encrypt, S for sign, B for both, and a bunch of other stuff. You get the idea. And then you can send your message, and it works. It works completely seamlessly, really. It will prompt you for the password, the whole nine yards. So enjoy your GPG and Mutt mail client for the two of my listeners that actually use Mutt and will be using GPG. And if you're not using Mutt, then you enjoy GPG on your other clients, whether it's Kmail or Thunderbird. Both of them utilize it really, really well. Oh, and Pine. All those use GPG quite smoothly. And you know, it's funny, I never really realized how smoothly it was until I started trying to get some of my Mac friends turned on to it. Wow, what a chore. I mean, there is just no communication between the command line and the GUI on Mac. It is miserable. And if you guys think that Android is any better, because that's a big layer of GUI right on top of your code, it's not a pleasant thing to experience. I'm warning you right now. So there you go, that's GPG, and an admonishment to stick with X. That's about it for this show, I think, so thanks for listening. This has been Episode 1 of Season 7 of the GNU World Order. You can find us online at ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. You can reach me at notclat2@jabber.org if you're on Jabber, or notclat2 on the Freenode network if you do IRC. You can also email me at clat2@member.fsf.org. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Now you're just wasting my time.